This is the Future of IP Protection podcast, brought to you by MorphVision. This show is dedicated to arming companies with the skills, know-how, and technology they will need to future-proof their IP protection strategy for the years ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Future of IP Protection podcast. I'm Brandi Spence, Head of Marketing with MorphVision. Today, I am speaking with Vivek Jayaram, founder of Jayaram Law, known as the Lawyers for Innovators and supporting cutting-edge creators and changemakers. But that's not all. Vivek is also known for his innovative approach to legal education, and he's famously teaching a course at the University of Miami School of Law titled Blank Space, IP Through the Lens of Taylor Swift's Career. Vivek has a knack for breaking down IP topics into digestible content, and that's what's made him a popular figure on social media. And as a huge Taylor Swift fan and an enthusiast of IP, that's how I first came to learn about him and his content through my social feeds. So I'm really super excited to have him on. And it's a pleasure to have you on, Vivek. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Brandi. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, likewise. So let's kick things off. Tell us about your journey in the field of IP law and what had you start your law firm?
Well, that's a big question. Long journey. I guess I'll start in the most logical place is really the beginning. I mean, I've been a sort of arts and culture and technology geek for about as long as I can remember. You know, I remember being like 15 years old and my parents got us a Prodigy account and a dial-up modem connection. And I feel like ever since then, I've loved just exploring and experimenting with new technologies. And so when I graduated law school, you know, that meant in the early days, I was working on like cases that were like the fallout from Napster and LimeWire. A couple of years later, we had social media and YouTube. We had, I think, you know, MySpace and YouTube first, and then Facebook, and then later on Instagram and the rest of them. And then with mobile app development, I was always, you know, working pretty closely with clients there. And then I would say over the last decade, it's really been a lot of cryptocurrency, blockchain, and AI on the technology side. And then you sort of marry that with like my personal passions for most of my life, which has been music and fashion and contemporary art. And all those things sort of jumbled up together. I think if you were to like create some kind of like potpourri out of those things, you would end up with Jayaram Law. So I don't know if that really explains it, but the practical side of it is, you know, I graduated law school in New York about 20 years ago, and I just loved IP in law school. I really enjoyed studying it, particularly copyright and trademark, and I was really keen on working for a federal judge. I thought it would be a sort of an honor and a really great sort of learning experience. And so I applied for clerkships all over the country, and I ended up landing one down in the 11th Circuit with an unbelievable, incredible Cuban judge who I really till today would still call a mentor for me. And his name is Bert Jordan. And so the plan was to do that 1 year clerkship and to go back to New York where I had a job lined up. But that didn't really happen because about 6 months through my clerkship, I met my now wife at the old Miami Art Museum downtown, which doesn't even exist anymore. And we've now been married a long time and we've been together for about 20 years. But that kept me in Miami, spent a few years in big law. I had an entrepreneurial streak my whole life. Big law for me was a great place to learn, but I was not really crazy about the culture. And so I decided to set out on my own. And in 2009, I started Jayaram Law. And it was really a pretty singular focus, which is I wanted to work with the most creative people on the planet. And for me, that was really twofold. It was, of course, wanting to work with really creative clients, brands and entrepreneurs and fashion people and creative contemporary artists and musicians and filmmakers and all of those kinds of things. But it also meant trying to find the most creative people that I could bring into the firm to work with me on these things. And people who really had a passion for arts and culture and for technology and the sort of things that I wanted to work with. So where I sort of ended up with, or what I ended up with, was a practice that focused on, you know, fashion, arts and culture, and technology. But we really, from the very beginning, I have built it really to be more in the mold of the people I want to represent rather than like other law firms. So I've kind of blissfully and willfully and intentionally ignored the legal industry for 15 years. And it's been, frankly, pretty joyful to do it that way. And I'm really happy with what we've built so far, but I'm also very excited for the future. And now 15 years later, we've got a team of about 30, 35 people between New York and Chicago and Miami. And we're really still rowing in that same direction of working with the most creative people we encounter, solving their biggest problems. And, you know, as you know, what a time to be an IP lawyer, right? It's gone from a really niche practice to one that is at the core and foundation and center of moving culture. And in my view, there's really no more exciting place to be.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. What an interesting pathway for you. And I love how you've really stuck to your core and really have practiced, you know, within that realm that you love, that artist creative vibe. Talk to me a little bit. As I mentioned, I've learned about you through my social feeds and I saw this blank space, a course that you taught at the University of Miami that really garnered a lot of attention. What inspired you to take on this unique approach to teaching IP law?
Yeah. So I guess I've always been more interested, you know, me personally, just in like moving culture more than moving money, I guess you could say. So this idea of working with creative people in creative spaces has just always been interesting. I've been teaching at the University of Miami for about, you know, 8 years now. And the approach that I've brought really from the very beginning is probably one that some people might say is unorthodox or a little bit different. But I have always thought, and it's really through my own experience, I think, going back to when I took a Beatles course at the University of Wisconsin in the late 90s, which was like, you know, sort of unusual even then, like in the humanities, right, in a big university, now much more common. But I've always tried to think about the students and really put the students front and center. And when I look across the room, and this goes back to 2016, and I see a group of students who are largely in their 20s and who are largely sort of interested in a lot of things, you know, in pop culture and culture that are going to be probably wildly different from the things that I was sort of into when I was in my 20s, right? And so I've always thought that the best way to teach something really complex and technical like the law is to teach it through the lens of something that is relatable and accessible for the students for a few reasons. It just makes it easier for them to understand when the context in which they're being taught these sort of complex things is a context that they're very familiar with. So if you lead with familiarity and then you sort of introduce the complex topic through that familiarity, the students I've noticed for years remain much more engaged. And when you remain engaged for a 60, 90 or 120 minute lecture, that's not an easy thing to do. And so if they can remain engaged, that's like half the battle. When you remain engaged, then when, you know, the lights go down and you leave the classroom, well, then you start continuing to like be interested in learning about those things and reading the cases that have been assigned to you and maybe even, you know, looking at things independently adjacent to whatever the professors asked you to look at. And that's when you really grasp the material, right? Because then you're hooked and you want to figure out how this material not only maybe affects the context which it's being taught in, but hey, how might it affect you? How might it affect other things that you're interested in, right? So if I dial it back, I've taught copyright and trademark litigation courses where the cases that we're talking about are ones that are sort of in the popular media and the current contemporary media. I've taught a course on law firm innovation, right? How to sort of look at things in this sort of new way. I've taught a course that was also pretty popular that was the semester before the Taylor Swift class, which was called ChatENT. And that was really talking about the onset of generative AI and how, you know, ChatGPT was the first time we're sort of commercially hearing about things, but this is something I've been into for a few years. And so talking about this copyright conundrum and how generative AI is going to have this really, I think, outsized impact on copyright law already has, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And so I've left each one of these experiences sort of being really, I guess, pleased and grateful that the students seem to be learning. And, you know, it's amazing how well the exams are written when it's on a topic that they all really love, right? So that leads us to, I think, about, I would say, around Thanksgiving time of 2022. I was just chatting with my buddy, Greg Levy, who's a dean at the law school. Greg's fantastic and has done an unbelievable job of building up the entertainment, arts, and sports law program at UM, which I really do think is blazing new trails in the U.S. in terms of legal education. But I was just remarking to him, I'm like, oh, look, like, you know, there's this new record Midnights that's coming out. And I had just like sort of done a little bit of a deep dive on the copyright implications of all the re-recording that Taylor Swift was doing. And I even had, you know, we do a lot of like counterfeit work and stuff like that, as I know you do too. And I read about her Alibaba deal that she was able to sort of pull off. And I just was thinking about all of this taken together, as well as this Evermore trademark lawsuit. And I said to myself, wow, what a comprehensive career for somebody who's only 33 years old, you know? And I'm like, she's not only, you know, written so much music, toured the world, done all of the things that you would expect a major global pop star to do, but she has also wrestled with some very thorny IP issues. And so that was really the start of it. And I think by the time 2023 rolled around, I just said to Greg, hey, listen, this fall, I think I'm going to teach this class. You know, here's what it's called. Here's some topics. And I think it raised some eyebrows within the law school, you know, and probably even in the administration. But I think once the course got going, and I think once we saw how long the wait list was and how much the students were enjoying the course, it was really a treat. And I think we all had a great time with the material. And, you know, it didn't stop there. So, I mean, I might teach it again, by the way. I mean, I'm not teaching right now in the spring semester, but I'm thinking of maybe doing an update of it in the fall or in the spring. But what's actually really exciting is we took this opportunity. I mean, at the firm, so at Jairam, we do a bunch of different things. And we've obviously got the legal services part of the firm, but we also develop our own legal tech. We've got a trademark product that's coming out in Q2. And as part of sort of like all of the sort of ancillary things that we do, we love teaching. I'm one of four people at the firm who teach. And so we're actually putting together a whole CLE suite, and we just finished recording, and it's in post-production right now. We've got like a 4-hour course, which is the Blank Space course, a little bit modified from how I did it at UM, but that same material, and that's going to be available in the next few weeks.
How exciting. And now you've opened it up, I think, right well beyond that for everyone else. So
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I already alluded to the many different things in terms of technology, right, that are disrupting and changing the IP landscape. How would you sort of describe that landscape as we stand today? We'll take a look at the future in a minute, but as we stand today, how do you describe the current state of IP protection?
It's a really, like I said before, such an interesting and layered time, right, with this stuff. So I think there's a few things from, I would say, in the copyright space, right? I mean, this is just IP generally, we're seeing a few things that I think are making it an interesting time, right? So like on the one hand, we have this explosion in transformational technology, right? And I think now at this point, everybody can agree that, you know, even though we've had things like blockchain and, you know, other kinds of digital assets, cryptocurrency, nothing really has the capacity to transform the sort of digital world and the internet in the way that we've known it, more than artificial intelligence, right? And so you've got this really powerful transformational technology on the one hand, but then you've got this nearly 50-year-old Copyright Act on the other hand, right? And I think we somehow were able to sort of sidestep the landmines in the first 30 years of the digital revolution, right? Living with this old Copyright Act. And I think the judges and the lawyers, we all did our best to sort of fit all of these things like social media and digital assets into this like Copyright Act that we've had. But I think we've now seen, you know, with the Chris Castanova case and with Stephen Thaler and a bunch of others, I think we've now seen like, okay, there seems to be a gap between the act and reality, right? And so whether I think it's the appellate courts or Congress, right, I do think we're going to need some additional guidance on how to deal with that copyright conundrum, right? But then on the flip side, right, and I guess depending on how you look at it, it might be consistent with what I just said, but I can also see an argument for saying, hey, this is actually runs counter to what you just said. But we've also seen what I would really define as a pretty material and, you know, extraordinary healing back of the fair use doctrine in the last, say, 12 to 15 months, right? So 2023 was a real banner year for fair use, but maybe not in the way that we would have thought, right? If you look at the previous 20 years, so, you know, starting with the Andy Warhol case, and then you've had, you know, obviously the Wavy Baby case, which I'm sure we're both very familiar with, you know, dealing with mischief. We also had the
Daniels, Jack case. Spaniels.
Yeah, the Bad Spaniels case. We had the Meta Birkin case. And I just saw a couple of days ago, we've got these two Richard Prince settlements, right? So there is no doubt that the new sort of composition of the Supreme Court, you know, post-Trump era, is issuing opinions that are narrowing the fair use doctrine, trying to interpret and apply Rogers in a meaningful way. And it's hard, right? So there's just a lot of uncertainty in IP right now. And I think, sure, while I think you could look at the last 30 years and say, well, anytime you're dealing with likelihood of confusion or substantial similarity or whether or not something's transformative, right? These are all very gray, fact-intensive, case-by-case issues. And so we've always struggled with this. I think there's some truth to that. But I think if you were to draw a line between, you know, the old Ed Sullivan cases going all the way up through the Google Oracle Supreme Court cases that we got, you know, the final decisions, I think, early in the pandemic, I think you could make a pretty strong and colorable argument that fair use was just sort of expanding year over year over year. And we were sort of giving more and more rights to parodists and artists and people who want to engage with satire and things like that, more and more rights. And I think everybody seemed to be feeling good about that, maybe because we're getting used to it. And I think now these last couple of years have sort of, the pendulum has shifted. And so now it's up to, you know, lawyers and advocates, you know, creatives, everybody, to figure out what the new sort of playing field is going to look like for the next 50 years.
You know, and that brings us now to, as you mentioned, like if you strike the balance, right, between fostering innovation and robust IP protection, I mean, that's really, it's really critical. I had a recent guest who was also talking about how what we've seen is a lot more flexibility and a lot more stretch in how brands are using their intellectual property nowadays. So given some of that, I mean, how do you advise your customers to navigate this difficult IP, you know, this delicate balance between innovation and protecting their IP rights and everything, yeah, and making sure they're not infringing on others' IP rights, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. And we've got a pretty unique practice because on the one hand, I am working with a lot of really extraordinary contemporary artists, emerging fashion brands, you know, all kinds of like emerging content makers, right? And then on the other hand, I'm also working with some of the largest companies in the world with, you know, some of the most valuable IP in the world. And so it's interesting to see how both sides are wrestling with this. And I think one reason a lot of clients, you know, maybe like working with us is because we do have that other perspective in-house, you know? So like I would say on the big brand side, I'll be honest with you. I think if I'm representing a big brand with sort of legacy IP, I would say now is a good opportunity to explore being a little bit more aggressive with takedowns and cease and desist letters and really staking claim to your house IP in a way that maybe a decade ago or even 5 years ago would have been more difficult because of the latitude granted initially by district courts and ultimately bubbling up into the appellate courts and even the Supreme Court on this fair use issue, right? And so the landscape was different. I mean, even when we were sometimes advising brands to take some kind of action, you know, we'd get the call back like, hey, listen, we got it. We love that you're looking out for us, but the courts are not going to agree because they might think this is a joke or they might think that this is just a work of art, right? But then on the other hand, I've always long believed really lead the way and hold the torch when it comes to intellectual property. I think they are also now wrestling with what can we do without a license, you know, and they don't necessarily think that way. It's sort of in a linear way, the way lawyers might look at it. But I do sometimes wonder, and it's too early to tell, but I do wonder whether some of the kinds of art that gained sort of prominence in the last 10 to 15 years, whether that kind of conceptual art will either be the art that is challenging this conundrum, or whether that was an era and now, no pun intended, and now whether we are going to be simply seeing contemporary artists and conceptual artists maybe turn to something else. I don't know. So I think that's really the state of things right now. Lots of uncertainty, two sort of clear-ish sides, you know, emerging and appearing. And then now it'll sort of be left to all of us, you and I, people, all of our colleagues, as well as like the bench and the legislators to figure out, you know, how we're going to contend with all this.
Interesting times for sure. All right, let's turn to something else. Given your experience, what are some of the common IP mistakes that you're seeing some of the creators and innovators make? And I think you address a few of those throughout your videos I've seen, which have been very interesting.
So I think making content has never been easier. And that, I think, is amazing, right? Because, you know, I'm still one of the remaining techno-optimists. I still think technology can solve more problems than it creates. I acknowledge that it creates problems, but I do believe that it's solving a lot of problems. You know, on the one hand, you've got, you know, Let's take generative AI. In one hand, you've got deepfake Taylor Swift's, which I think we can all agree is wrong and bad, right? But on the other hand, look at what generative AI has already done in healthcare, for example, right? Look what it has already done in terms of providing access to education, right? These are really big and important things in America and around the world. And so I do believe that technology is ultimately a good thing. So for creators now, anybody can be a creator, right? Anybody can create content. And I think because of that, and because it's so easy to distribute content, it becomes a lot easier for people to step into an infringement situation, right? And you may say, oh, but the music's original. Well, yeah, but you've got like all these trademarks and things like all over your video, right? Okay, well, I don't have any logos or anything. The music's original. Yeah, but now you're showing images of other people. And so you've got a publicity rights issue, right? And so there's all of these sort of landmines that, you know, I'm seeing not just creators create, but like now you've got major brands, right, who post on Instagram or TikTok literally every day because that's how you have success on those platforms. And oftentimes, right, even major brands, I'm seeing that there's not really time to do thorough clearance. And that's cool too, right? We don't want lawyers holding up sort of that kind of thing. But I do think that like the clearing of content, right, the uncertainty in fair use, right, these things I think are making it maybe more difficult to avoid exposure if you're a creator. But honestly, I don't think creators are really thinking about it that way. And they're just sort of like forging ahead. So I think then on the brand side or on the IP holder side, I think what I'm seeing more now than I've ever seen in my career is, I've been doing about 20 years, is everyone's seeing infringement. There's infringement everywhere. But what are the infringements that are actually causing economic harm? And I'm seeing people sort of focused on that issue a lot more intently and intensely and sort of being a little bit more selective, you know, from an enforcement standpoint.
Yeah, certainly. That makes me think perhaps of like the Luke Combs situation where, I don't know if you recall, there was a sweep of counterfeiters that were
sued. Oh, yeah, I did see that.
Yeah. And if they had the one fan that was just like trying to make a little money and she had a situation, he was like, yeah, no, this is not meant for like a you type of fan, you know? But yeah.
That's a great point. That's actually a good example of like the kind of thing we're seeing, because I know you do a lot of brand protection. You know, we work a lot with those kinds of companies and they're all providing a really valuable service and a lawful service, right? I think in the Luke Combs situation, I know we didn't discuss that much, but certainly I don't think he was out of bounds from a legal standpoint, right?
Certainly not.
Yeah, but we all know we're not representing laws. We're representing actual people and actual companies. And so when you're working in that space, it just needs to be handled on a case by case. And there's all kinds of sensitivities that come into play.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, let's put our crystal ball on, I guess. Polish it off. Let's look 5 years from now. There's a lot going on right now. What do you think the future of IP protection is going to look like? And how do you see your role and your law firm's role evolving in the years to come?
Wow, good question. So, I mean, a few things. I mean, I think we have been pretty active, you know, both with clients, but then also with, you know, providing comments to the Copyright Office and things like that, you know, in this generative AI space. And I do think that that is going to have a pretty big impact on IP generally in the next few years. But then I also think that, like, I think generative AI, I don't think it's going to eliminate jobs, you know, legal jobs, but I do think generative AI will be able to perform a lot of the tasks that various people in the legal industry currently perform, humans, right?
Mm-hmm.
But rather than like taking those jobs away, I just think that like those people will then sort of move on to other sort of roles within the legal industry, which often happens when you have new sort of emerging technology appear, right, in the world. But I am pretty bullish on the idea that law firms who are able to sort of develop their own proprietary technology to do various things, right, will be pretty valuable in the future. Because I think our value as lawyers is really, you know, yeah, sure, maybe it is drafting a brief or putting together a contract, yes. But really, what is the magic in that, or what is the really expertise in that, is really the exercising of judgment and decision making, right? And I think we have not come anywhere near replacing or being able to replicate or duplicate that with technology. Maybe that happens at some point, but right now I don't think we're anywhere near that. And so I do think those functions will still be front and center for a lawyer, but I think firms and, you know, groups of lawyers, you know, providing services to people should start thinking about developing technology that gives you a competitive edge in the marketplace, just in the way that lawyers and law firms for decades now have tried to, you know, gain a competitive edge through acquiring talent, right? And I think that that talent, will that will still be an important question. But I do think that in 10 years, the firms that are harnessing the most effective and useful technology for clients will be the firms that sort of maybe rise to the forefront of the industry.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely that key technology along with that specialized expertise, it has to come hand in hand. And
Yeah.
I'm curious what you think of that technology. Do you think it'll play a role with the bench, with the laws? Will we see them adopted in a way that it will hopefully evolve as well and make faster perhaps some of the decision making that they do?
Yeah, you know, I did an Instagram video and a post about the role of AI when it comes to judges and lawyers. And I got some DMs from some lawyers, you know, kind of be like, oh, come on, you're crazy. You think a judge is going to actually use generative AI? You know, of course, these are good debates. I always welcome these debates. I think they're very useful because to every point that I've made on this podcast, there's a super legitimate counterpoint, you know? But what was funny is about a week after that post, and I'm now forgetting which district it was, but a chief judge in, it was not Southern District of New York, but it was a pretty busy district, came out and said something somewhat similar, which is like, yeah, no, certainly we will be using in the courts generative AI to do a whole bunch of things, right? Including assisting us with certain kinds of decision making, right? And it may not be, hey, ChatGPT, tell me, you know, how to rule on the summary judgment motion, but I do think that we're now just seeing the very, very early glimpses of this powerful generative AI technology. And I don't think it's too hard to imagine at this point in a few years, you know, if you're dealing with likelihood of confusion, right? Which is like trying to suss out whether something is confusing to consumers, right? When they encounter a certain logo or mark or whatever in the marketplace, or whether two pieces of copyright content are substantially similar, you can imagine generative AI assisting a decision maker in figuring that out in the same way, by the way, that we've been using like surveys in trademark cases, or in the way that we, you know, bring in super decorated experts to testify on substantial similarity or damages or whatever in a copyright case, right? So I think judges absolutely will be using this stuff. You know, it'll take some time as it always does. I think the government generally moves quite a bit slower than the pace of technology. We've seen that over the last 20 years. But yeah, I think that's going to happen. And frankly, as we're talking, that probably already is happening to some degree with some judges in some courts.
I think it's going to certainly be very interesting to watch. Well, for our listeners who are budding entrepreneurs, innovators, creators, what are three pieces of actionable advice that you would offer them when it comes to protecting their intellectual property?
Pick the things that are most valuable to you that you're making and protect those things early. And do what you need to do to accomplish that, right? If you go to a lawyer and they're too expensive, find one who will work with you, right? Find one who will understand where you are in your career and will work with you. I mean, we do this all the time. I might represent some giant public companies, but like we also work with, you know, unrepresented new artists who graduated art school last year, right? And who are preparing for like their first shows and things like that. So you can find people who, if they believe in you and they understand what you're doing, you can get that protection. So A, I would say that. Two, treat your work, if you're a creative and an artist, treat your work like a business, right? Try to make as much money as you can, right? These are sometimes ideas and things that like are a little bit, have historically been maybe a little bit taboo for like creative people to think about. But here's why that's important, right? I want all artists, all creatives to make money, the good ones and the bad ones. It doesn't matter. I want every creative person to make money, because when you make money, that's how you can ensure that you have the stability to continue making work throughout your career, right? So that shouldn't be something we don't talk about, right? The reason artists should earn a living is because that is what allows them to put art out into the world, you know, for the rest of their lives, right? So treat it like a business, because when you treat it like a business, it will then be the thing that allows it to become sustainable. And I know as artists that is ultimately what you all want, right? And so I would say treat it like a business. And third, you know, and I've just seen this now, I don't know that 10, 15 years ago, I would be able to see this because I was still younger. I was newer to doing all of this. I hadn't seen as much. But given what I see now, I would also say to creatives is like, it's such a buzzword, but it's just so true, is this idea of authenticity, right? Be who you are unabashedly, right? If you are a painter and all you want to do is paint oils on canvas, you don't have to make digital art because that's all of a sudden popular for a little while, right? If you are, you know, an entrepreneur and you really want to solve a big problem and blockchain or generative AI is no part of that, you know, problem or solution, that's okay. Go solve it, right? If that's really what you're passionate about, right? And so I think that like maybe those are three things that I would say, you know, just from what I've seen would be maybe good things to keep your eye on.
Oh, for sure. I think your last point, especially about authenticity, has become even more so important than ever now in this cluttered, you know, social environment we're in and this AI environment that we're in. And, you know, just authenticity is so important, and more brands are jumping in on everything. So yeah, I think that was a really key one for sure. And treating it like a business, monetizing your IP, find those ways to monetize your IP for sure.
Totally. And here's the thing, I think the other problem, and you know, it used to be, I used to talk about this in the context of like the New York Times technology section or something like that. I think now literally we could just refer to like any social media platform, right? There is this like sense, and it's not reality. I mean, at least in the hundreds, maybe even thousands of like companies and clients I've worked with over the 20 years, like there's a sense that if you decide to do something, right, that like it must scale and be a success within like 48 hours, right? It's like, that just isn't how things work, right? And when I look at, you know, we just finished a year, right? Everybody just finished a year. We did a little bit of reflecting on, you know, what we did this year, who the clients are, blah, blah, blah. Year after year after year after year, it doesn't matter what new technology has come out, what new fad, what new this, what new that, right? Whatever it may be, the clients that we see and the people that we see who attain the kind of success that they all want, whatever that kind of success is, that formula has not really changed, right? And from my perspective, I really feel that it's like picking something that you love, right? This is the authenticity part, right? It's working really, really hard on that thing, right? I've still not met a successful person who doesn't work really, really hard ever, right? And so picking something you love, working really hard at it, and sticking with that vision for an extended period of time, right? And I've met so many really smart entrepreneurs who like, you know, something doesn't work in a couple of years, they're on to the next thing, and then they're on to the next thing, and then they're on to the next thing, right? And that's great. I mean, in a way that can really satisfy some intellectual curiosity and those kinds of things. And if that's really what you want to do, that's great. But if what you're trying to do is create something sustainable and everlasting and all of that, that is what it took before I practiced law. That is what it takes now. And I do believe 50 years from now, that's still what it's going to take to sort of accomplish whatever objective you may have out there.
Fantastic advice. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, I got to end on a Taylor Swift note here, okay?
All right, let's go.
All right. Tell us what your favorite Taylor Swift song is and why.
All right. I'll answer this, but I want to come at it circuitously. So, you know, I've grown up and been playing music really for as long as I can remember in bands, and I'm always listening to music. And most of what I listen to, I mean, it's very eclectic. I probably grew up a lot on like indie rock and hip hop and jazz. And I think those are probably the things that, you know, I still turn to the most, but I'm always just listening to literally music from all over the world, singer songwriter stuff, instrumental stuff, like electronic stuff, like whatever I can get my hands on that I think is interesting. And I can't say that I loved Taylor Swift when she first came out, you know, say 15 years ago or so, right? But for me, what drew me in was 1989. And I don't know if it was because at that time I was already a fan of Ryan Adams, and then he covered 1989, and we can leave Ryan Adams aside, our opinions of him now. But I really love 1989. And when I heard it, I felt, wow, what a cool record that combines really, really good songwriting with like this electronic component and this very poppy component. But there's still that like core Nashville-ness of it, which like gives it a little bit of like an anchor. And so I fell in love with that record. I mean, and I just listened to it nonstop for a long time. And as often happens, that then you start thinking, what else is this, you know, artist done? And of course, I knew the hits and things like that, but like, I just never did the deep dive. And then, you know, when the pandemic came some years later, and then Folklore and Evermore, which, you know, were kind of satisfied like the sort of indie songwriter side of me, I felt like I kind of became all in. And so if I really am going to answer this honestly, even though 1989 is my favorite album, I was just talking about this with my wife the other day. I think it's hard to argue against the fact that All Too Well, especially the Taylor's version, is not just almost the perfectly crafted pop song. The lyrics are meaningful, so specific when she's talking about dancing, you know, in that refrigerator light and all of that. Like, these are things that must have happened, right? Mm-hmm. At least that's what the listener believes. And when the songwriter can convey something so specific that a listener is only left with the fact that that must be the songwriter's reality, whether it is or not, right? That to me is the goal of art, is to connect at that sort of cellular level with another human being. And you know, even people like my wife who teased me endlessly for liking Taylor Swift for so many years, people like that, when you sit there and you're able to get them to listen to a song like All Too Well, right? I think it's whatever, then there's millions of naysayers out there when it comes to Taylor Swift. We all know that, right? Just like anybody famous, right? But I think my hardcore music friends, you know, whoever else, when you play that song for them, I think it's pretty undisputedly like a pretty brilliant song.
I hope we're talking about Taylor's version here, right?
That's what I said, the Taylor's version.
Oh, yeah, you did say that. Sorry. Yeah.
They're both great, though. Like, I'm not going to...
I mean, they both are, yeah. But that 10-minute Taylor's version you're right.
And, you know, it's hard because there's only a few songwriters, you know, I would say Bob Dylan, maybe Elliot Smith, I Love Phoebe Bridgers, I would say somebody contemporary, probably somebody like her, who can hold your attention for 10 minutes writing verse after verse, right? And that's not easy. And I tell people, I think that's what people forget. She comes from a very Nashville tradition. So that's kind of the trick. That's like her secret weapon that most other pop stars, right? Michael Jackson, Madonna, whoever you want to talk about, they don't have that. They didn't have that, right? And so she's anchored by this very powerful folk tradition where you're literally judged on the power and the strength of your songwriting. And I think that just really shows and shines on that song.
Oh, I would 100% agree with you. It definitely pulls your heartstrings in and connects with you in every way, shape, and form.
For sure.
Quite good. Well, listen, thank you so much for bringing all these complex issues to the forefront and giving us your unique perspective. I think that is all the time we have, but I really appreciate having you on and having you share all your insights with us. Real quickly, if anybody would like to follow you or learn more about Jairam Law, where can they go?
You can follow me on Instagram at Vivek Jairam, or you can follow us at Jairam Law on Instagram. You can follow me on LinkedIn. We've got TikTok. We're kind of all over. So if you just, you know, any one of those places, I love hearing from you, love engaging in the discourse. And I really appreciate you having me on the show, Brandy. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Future of IP Protection podcast brought to you by Mark Vision. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you'd like to learn more about how Mark Vision can help you transform your IP protection strategy, visit us at markvision.com. Thanks again, and I'll catch you on the next episode.